The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, your fill-in host for today. I'm covering for Mr. Stephen Fleury and some of the other substitutes. I'm coming to you today from this beautiful studio here in Edstone, England, the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. I'm over here with my family enjoying the Feast of Tabernacles with about 200 people, just under that in the Philadelphia Church of God. And today is the family day. And so if you hear any noise of some children playing on a bouncy castle, they could be my own. I hope to get back down there to join them very shortly. But we've got a wonderful program today. We're going to cover a couple of stories that I think aren't really covered that much in the mainstream media. You might not have heard too much about them. But what they show is that we have across the world now being pushed by the Biden administration, a very adversarial foreign policy to do with both Israel and even the southern border relating to the nation of Venezuela. So we're going to cover two main stories in the news section of today's program before I'll get to the second half where we'll discuss some about family. If you've listened much to more of the programming at thetrumpet.com, you might know me from the Let the Stone Speak podcast. This is where we talk about biblical archaeology. I'm typically based in Israel with my family, and I'm just here on vacation or for the Feast of Tabernacles. But I can't get away from a couple of these stories that are breaking. One broke last week, another just breaking today. The first of these is in reference to Israel, the relationship between Israel and Lebanon, and the border dispute that's been taking place, well, has taken place for the past 10 years, and it looks to now be finally resolved. Now, if you know anything about Lebanon, this is a country just to the north of Israel, about 5 million people, about a million of those are Syrian refugees. Country is in absolute disarray. Of course, you have Hezbollah, one of the largest political parties. They are the terrorist group turned political party that really makes sure that whatever happens in Lebanon really does fit what they desire. And of course, Hezbollah is in a relationship with Iran. They get their sponsorship, their funding from the Lebanese state, as well as from Iran. They get their direct direction from Iran as well. And so Israel has been negotiating with Lebanon where exactly the border should be between the two countries. Not necessarily the land border, that's been decided upon decades ago, but what about the maritime border? Now, as you probably realize, the Eastern Mediterranean is a place where there's a lot of exploration going on for gas and oil and other areas, other things, other commodities. And this is at a time when the world needs this. And so right where the border of Israel should be and Lebanon across into the ocean to the Mediterranean Sea goes, you've had both parties kind of dueling for the lion, trying to grab more of what would be considered a potentially lucrative oil field. And so, or gas field. And so what we see here going on is this dispute over territory, over this fuel. And what we've seen brokered today was that a new deal has been made between Israel and Lebanon. And when I say Lebanon, I mean this proxy of this state that's beholden to Hezbollah, which is a proxy of Iran. And it severely favors the Lebanese. Now, there's an interesting backstory as to why this has happened, and we'll get to that. But first, I'd like to just cover what this deal means. And if you could put up there in the studio there this map. This is a it's a maritime border. dispute between Lebanon and Israel is put together from the Times of Israel. And it shows you kind of where these lines have been drawn out to the ocean. And you have this first one, line number one, that was drawn in. This was the first line, that prospective line, and it goes through right through this Cana gas field. And this was the negotiating point of Israel and Lebanon for the past, let's say, past 10 years. It was the negotiating point between Israel and Lebanon in negotiations brokered by the Trump administration. And so this was the first agreed line. Lebanon, they thought the line should be here. Israel thought it should be here. And there was a negotiation that was taking place where this gas field, it looked like 60% would go to Lebanon, and 40% or 55 and 60, 55, some 45, something like that would go to Israel. So that was the first line. Then Hezbollah came back during the Trump administration and says, no, the line should be further to the south. This means most of the Cana gas field should be ours. And so then what you have is Israel kind of negotiating with that, with the Trump administration brokering it. And then finally, in the last days of the Trump administration, the Hezbollah-led Lebanese government, they said, no, we don't want that anymore. We actually want number 29, line 29, which is even further to the south, which would already engulf another one of Israel's gas fields, the Karish gas field. And so Hezbollah put up the ante and said, we want all of it, in fact. And if you start drilling here at this gas field, we're going to destroy your refineries and attack you at sea. And so that's where it stalled. That's where it stalled, even into the government of President Biden. Now, all of this changed 5 weeks ago. All of this changed 5 weeks ago from an unlikely source, or you could see it as an unlikely source. This is from Haaretz. Haaretz is a left-leaning paper in Israel. It's highly unpopular amongst most Israelis. It's more popular amongst the diplomatic corps, I would say, located in Israel, but not too many people read it actually in Israel. And so take that as you may. However, they are the only ones that caught up, that showed us in this report, something very interesting that took place on August 31st. So this is going back a certain amount of time, a couple of months. And there was a phone call between Yair Lapid, who's the prime minister of Israel, and he's a prime minister, a caretaker prime minister. He wasn't voted into that office in terms of coming into this office, being the most popular politician in Israel. Of course, Israel has a different way of governing than the United States or other countries. And right now we have Israel only 3 weeks away from an election. And so this government has failed. This government by Yair Lapid has failed. It formerly led by Naftali Bennett, who lied to the Israeli public saying he would never do a deal with Yair Lapid to end up getting into, or the Arab parties that Yair Lapid was allied with to get into office. But he took that back and did the deal. And by virtue of that deal, if the government ever failed, Yair Lapid would come into power. And he's a lefty, completely. Left-wing, kind of like an Israeli version of a Democrat, I would say, or a more socialist Democrat, put it that way. And so he's now in power, overseeing the government before Israel goes into a new election, which is on November 1st. So just a couple of weeks away. And so many Israelis, as we'll get to, they're even looking at this deal saying, by what authority do you have to demarcate a new boundary of our nation with Lebanon as a caretaker? How in the world is this even possible? How is it in the world is this even legal? So why did it happen? Why is it being pushed through? Haaretz now. This is what they reported on October 3rd. They said this, on August 31st, Yair Lapid and Joe Biden held a phone call. Now, August 31st, not too long ago, the nuances of demarcation lines and gas lines and economic exclusive zones in the Eastern Mediterranean between Israel and Lebanon, probably not Joe Biden's forte at this stage. I don't know how many details he's fully cognizant of or aware of. However, he holds a phone call, and this phone call, there's a readout, as it says, of both offices. I'll just read from Haaretz. Afterward, the officers of both men issued a press release, as is customary, but used different language. Hiding in the White House version was a story that was missing from the announcement of the Prime Minister's office. So if you look at the two press releases after the call, they talk about similar things, except one thing is Israel's Prime Minister leaves off his press release, but it's included in the president's. It says this, quote, "The president also emphasized the importance of concluding the maritime boundary negotiations between Israel and Lebanon in the coming weeks." So I know you're a caretaker prime minister. I know you have no authority or even jurisdiction. I mean, the Israeli Supreme Court and the Israeli Attorney General right now is coming to bat for Lapid, but they're already part of the deep state. We already know that, and so there's no surprises there. There's one minister that's part of the government of Lapid that refuses to sign on to the deal because she says, hey, this should go to the electorate. This is a decision of national importance. It should not be made by a caretaker. And yet, it is being made by a caretaker, Prime Minister, and his cabinet. And this article continues. In other words, Biden simply told Lapid he was fed up with the delays and was sending his envoy, Amos Hochstein, to the region to complete the deal and enable the development of Israel's Karish and Lebanon's Khan natural gas fields. Now, this language, of course, it's from the Haaretz. Israel already has full right to develop the Karish gas field. Everyone will put that in Israel's territory. We're not even including that. This is all about Khana. Should it belong to Israel? Should it belong to Lebanon? So what is the deal that was pushed by the Biden administration? How bad was it? This is from the Times of Israel, just summarizing the deal. It says this, Lebanon will enjoy the economic benefits of the area north of Line 23. So Line 23, it's not the absolutely crazy line. This is the line that goes through the southern part of Khana. And this is the one that Hezbollah wanted initially before they kind of upped the ante to then increase their negotiating position to then back down a little bit. So everything north of that line, that's going to go to Hezbollah. Let's put it that way. Terrorist organization that's bent on destroying Israel and the United States if they could. They're going to get the economic benefits of everything north of that. Though the senior Israeli official, is quoting Times of Israel, said Jerusalem will receive monetary compensation for a certain percentage of revenue from the Khana, part of which lies south of Line 23. The exact compensation will be decided in future negotiations. So this is what it is. Hezbollah gets it all. Hezbollah gets all of the gas field. And then it's some compensation in the future, some percentage of the revenue will be hammered out. That will eventually be given to Israel. Right. It continues. Israel will also receive a letter of guarantees from the United States, stressing Washington's commitment to Israel's security and economic rights in case Hezbollah or another party fails to respect the deal. So basically said that, oh, we're going to sign on to this deal, Israel, okay? If Hezbollah-run Lebanon doesn't pay you the money that you deserve based on this agreement, we will go to work on them. Right. Like they're going to do that when they've been trying to give and they have given Iran access to billions and billions, $150 billion in the past Obama presidency, and now they're looking to give Iran even more right now. This is what United States Ambassador to Israel David Friedman said. He was President Trump's ambassador. He criticized this deal saying this, "We spent years trying to broker a deal between Lebanon and Israel on the disputed maritime gas fields. Got very close with proposed splits of 55 to 60% for Lebanon and 45 to 40% for Israel. No one then imagined 100% to Lebanon and 0% to Israel. Would love to understand how we got here." Well, Haaretz tells us how we got here. President Biden's press office told us how we got here. This was an agreement that was pushed on Israel, pushed on Lapid from the Biden administration, no friend to the state of Israel. This is what Jonathan Tobin, the great writer, editor-in-chief for Jewish News Syndicate, he wrote this about a few days ago. He said, it's that the drive, he talks about how the outcome, so how the initial negotiations started. He says, it's that the driving force behind the now abandoned agreement, so this agreement was abandoned last week and it got resurrected later on and signed today, or about to be signed, abandoned agreement was the determination of the United States and President Joe Biden to force Israel to agree to something that previous American and Israeli administrations never contemplated. So this deal came out of the woodwork. Hezbollah gets it all. Israel gets nothing apart from a security guarantee from Washington that they've got Israel's back in the future against Hezbollah. And then perhaps there's some monetary benefit that'll eventually flow down to Israel. That's all Israel gets. And Hezbollah gets everything. Jonathan Tobin continues this way. He says, Lapid walked into this trap because he's committed to a strategy of avoiding public disputes with Biden at all costs. For months, as the Americans moved closer to an agreement with Iran that he knew was antithetical to any notion of protecting the security of Israel or its Arab allies, he spoke of trying to influence the U.S. not to go down the path of appeasement. So he's talking about how negotiations between Iran for a new nuclear deal, they're ongoing, they're still there. And Lapid knows this is a horrible deal. And he's trying to keep Biden close and not make outward statements that are against Biden. But at the same time, he's trying to preserve Israel's security to a certain extent, knowing that if Iran gets the bomb, that Tel Aviv is the target. And so what's he going to do? Well, his whole foreign policy puts priority on number one on maintaining a relationship with the United States, even if that United States government seeks Israel's destruction. Now, I know it's a bold thing, comment to say that they would seek their destruction, but I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from America Under Attack that show you that that's exactly what the Obama administration was after. Of course, they've outsourced that. They're not going to do it themselves. They're outsourcing that by empowering Iran and Hezbollah and others, as we've seen. However, that is actually the end goal. Continuing here from Jonathan Tobin, he says this, seen from this perspective, it's clear that Lapid was not so much surrendering to Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, and a lot of Israelis are making this point now. This was not a surrender to Hezbollah, this deal that Israel has worked out with Lebanon, as he was to Biden. This was a direct capitulation to the American president, an American president that holds to Obama's policy of weakening allies and strengthening enemies. He continues this way, it remains to be seen whether Biden will tolerate, even if only for the 5 weeks until the U.S. election, Lapid's act of political survival and moving away from the Lebanon pact that the U.S. administration has ordered him to accept. So this article was written a week ago, and this was the time that Lapid was like, I can't even do it. This is too much for me. Giving 100% to Hezbollah-led Lebanon, I can't do it. Political suicide. Israeli base not going to even fall. Even my base knows this is a horrible deal. They know it's a surrender. I can't do it. So he backed out of it. And then something happened in the past week where the deal is back on the table. The U.S. says, we're going to guarantee your security and maybe you'll get some monetary benefit. But it's all Lebanon's. It's all Hezbollah's. This gas field, and Lapid changes scene, changes tune. He says this is Tobin, what is obvious, however, is that Lapid has not yet learned what Netanyahu came to understand during the course of his 15 years as prime minister, which is that while the United States is the greatest ally of Israel, it certainly is the case, and if you turn to talk about the population itself, you have to secure your national interest. And we saw Netanyahu boldly stand up to President Obama time and time and time again, and even go into the House of the American People and say, this is a horrible deal that President Obama is trying to ram through with the Iranians. It's going to hurt all of us. Look how much money they're going to get. Who's going to be the target? We are. And what do we have? A promise that sometime in the future, that when they get a nuclear weapon, as legally they would be able to under the nuclear deal, they won't fire at us. That was the best that the deal secured. And Netanyahu basically said, I'm not going to stand for it. I'm going to yell loud, and I'm going to become a watchman. And he was for a time. Now, Lapid is not going to do that. Lapid is not going to stand up to Biden, even when the Biden administration is pushing him to do things that are antithetical to Israel's national interest. There was a readout, of course. President Biden yesterday called Prime Minister Lapid, caretaker Prime Minister Lapid, we should say, in many ways just occupying a seat, just meant to keep things together until the electorate comes together and says, no, we want this policy. We want these politicians with certain policies that are going to represent us. That's what he's meant to do. That's not what he's doing. So he gets received a call from Prime Minister President Biden yesterday. And of course, Biden congratulated him and told him, quote, you're making history. Now, you should see all the spin that's being put on this now. Former Ambassador Shapiro, Obama's ambassador to Israel, just put out a piece, I think it's published on Times of Israel as well, saying that this is amazing. I mean, Lebanon and Israel, they don't even have diplomatic relations, and yet here we can square away a deal between both these states. This is the next Abraham Accords. Remember those? What President Trump kind of worked with the Arab states to bring, some Arab states, to bring a normalization agreement with Israel. It was Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and the last nation's failing me now. But he brought four nations to the table that were adversary to Israel, at least on paper, and their populations as such. And they were able to normalize relations. Direct flights between these two countries. Israelis tourists flocking now to the Gulf states, and some Gulf citizens coming to Israel. They were the Abraham Accords. They got a normalization agreement. They got some type of peace deal. Now, there's no peace deal here between Israel and Lebanon. Israel got nothing. Lebanon got everything. And we're supposed to hail this agreement as some type of next Abraham Accords. History was made, of course, but not the good type of history for Israel's sake. Biden said that the maritime deal announced by both governments on Tuesday will, quote, provide for the development of energy fields for the benefit of both countries, setting the stage for a more stable and prosperous region and harnessing vital new energy sources for the world. So it's interesting. I mean, we have a great need for gas and oil, and of course it's going to take years for these to come online. Nevertheless, this is what the Biden administration is saying. This is a great idea. This is a great idea for Israel and Lebanon, for the rest of the world. Hezbollah gets everything. Israel gets nothing apart from the promise of some future economic benefit. Now, how do you know a deal is bad when it's between Lebanon and Israel? For Israel, we're talking about. Well, all it takes is Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, to make a statement from his basement that is saying this is a good deal. And this is exactly what he said. Well, actually, I don't have the quote. I've got part of the quote for this deal. But basically, Times of Israel said, even Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah cautiously welcomed the agreement. I don't think it actually quoted him. It was in Arabic. While crediting his group's strategy of threatening and launching drones at Israel for helping spur the deal. So everybody's happy. Lebanon's happy. Hezbollah's happy. Biden's very happy. Or Biden's people, let's put it that way. Obama's people are happy. And the Israeli public, very unhappy. Yair Lapid, I reckon, too. I think he's probably pretty unhappy with this deal as well, although he's going to try and sell it with great gusto before the election on November 1st, which is not looking good for him actually right now. Of course, he forms, I guess, the second biggest party in Israeli politics, Yesh Lapid. There's not, Yesh Atid. There's not many other options, I think, for a charismatic politician in Israel that has the left, that has a certain amount of power, that could eventually weigh up to or size up against Netanyahu. Netanyahu, by the way, is polling as by far the favorite in the election, his Likud party. So we'll see what happens on November 1st. But I think the Israeli public actually might be a bit upset by this, and they might take it out on Yair Lapid. We'll see what will happen. I mean, why do you think Biden was going to push this through before the election? Well, obviously, he doesn't think too highly of Lapid's chances at staying in power in Israel. The second story I wanted to cover also has to do with Iran and might be a story that you haven't heard about. It was published in the New York Times October 1st. It's got to do with Iran. It's got to do with the Obama administration, President Biden's administration, and it's got to do with Venezuela. Now, this is something I've been watching for some time now, writing the occasional article about it. Anytime that we have Iran and Venezuela doing deals, and the Biden administration or the Obama administration, they're mediating, or not even mediating, they're in this, but behind the scenes working this out together. Now, you might not have known that there were some American prisoners that were released from Venezuela and Iran. This happened just a few days ago, 10 days or so ago. And you might remember prisoner swaps from days gone by. These are something that you don't typically do with adversarial states, unless you're the Biden administration or the Obama administration. I will read through this. It says this from October 1st, New York Times. Seven Americans who had been held captive in Venezuela for years were on their way home Saturday after President Biden agreed to grant clemency to two nephews of Cilia Flores, Venezuela's first lady. So these are Maduro's, the Venezuelan leader's wife's children. And they were arrested years ago for drug smuggling and other things. So these are bad guys. What are they called? The narco nephews. That's what they're known as in diplomatic circles. Efrain Antonio Campo Flores and Frankie Francisco Froes de Fritas. Well, they're back in Venezuela. They were caught in the United States. And I'll get to what they've done. And there was some innocent Americans that were sent home. It says the man had been sentenced in 2017 to 18 years in prison. That's a long time. For conspiring to smuggle cocaine into the United States. At the same time, Iran on Saturday released Siamak Namazi, a 51-year-old dual national Iranian-American businessman who'd been jailed since 2015. On a temporary furlough, and lifted the travel ban on his father. So, together, the announcements regarding Venezuela and Iran represent one of the largest mass releases of Americans detained abroad in recent memory. Though one American official said that the timing was coincidental. Coincidental, right. For Mr. Biden, freeing seven Americans, some of whom had been held for years in Venezuelan prison, was a part of an aggressive push to accelerate such homecomings, an effort that has drawn some criticism for the president's willingness to exchange convicted criminals. So here we have again, convicted criminals, bad guys, innocent civilians being kept abroad as hostages for future use, like this. And we have an Iranian-American national released, and then the narco nephews, they're released as well. A senior administration called the president's action to grant clemency a, quote, tough decision and a painful decision. But it was the only way, they said, to persuade Maduro to release the Americans. Right, only way to persuade him. This is Marco Rubio. Had these things to say. Well, you had a reporter. I listened to Matt Lee talk about this last week. He's the Associated Press reporter that sits in the State Department meetings. He's been there a long time. He's the guy that basically really goes at Ned Price and even Psaki. She was also the spokesperson for I think John Kerry back in the day in Obama administration. He would put them to task over just absolute incongruencies in policy. Anyhow, he's just a wonderful individual to follow in many ways. Anyhow, he pressed him on this, saying, well, these connected? I mean, Venezuela, bad guys sending back. We get some innocents back. And then there's the Iranians. We get an Iranian back. So we know that Iran is actively working with Venezuela to work out some type of deal, some type of a relationship where Venezuela gets access to its oil. Iran can help with that, producing the petrol from its oil. Iran is receiving lots of gold back for it and other things like that. We know they're working together. We know they're trying to circumvent U.S. sanctions together. And wait a second. An American comes back from Iran and Americans come back from Venezuela at the same time. Is there more to this? Absolutely not. Coincidence. A senior administration said that he hoped the Venezuelan president would realize that the president's decision was rare. Action that is not likely to be repeated. So they were asked, hey, is this going to really encourage or discourage further Americans innocent Americans for being taken captive? And, well, Maduro shouldn't get this idea. This is a rare thing. Not going to be repeated often. This is what Marco Rubio said on Twitter. Today, Biden releases two convicted drug dealer nephews of Venezuelan dictator, nephews, I should say, of dictator Maduro in exchange for seven innocent Americans being held hostage. Another Biden appeasement that will result in more anti-U.S. dictators taking more innocent Americans hostage in the future. It happens. Bo Bergdahl, back in, I think it was 2014 or a bit earlier, he was the deserter in Afghanistan. We'll get him back, or the United States will get him back. This is Obama's deal. They'll get five Taliban terrorists back that are actually now part of the Taliban government, that are ruling Afghanistan, that have access to billions of dollars of American weaponry. That's who was given back for Bo Bergdahl. What about the Iran nuclear deal? Remember that? The cash showing up, Swiss francs, showing up in an airport in Tehran and Americans being freed. Three Americans, I think it was, being freed at the same time. $400 million. And they tried so hard to say that there was just, you know, this was not, they were not connected. They were just giving them some cash. It ended up being $1.8 billion of cash eventually that came into this deal. But we got some Americans back. Now, really, the Biden administration, Obama administration, they wanted to give that money to the Iranians. The hostages, receiving the hostages was an excuse to do so. And Iran, they said those hostages are not coming off the tarmac or off our soil until the money lands. So they're the type of deals that are par for the course for this administration. So I don't know if you'd heard about that story, but I do think it's very important to watch what's going on in Venezuela right now. Venezuela is a country that's on its knees in many ways, and Iran is a country. Well, I shouldn't say that they're on their knees, because that means that the government's going to probably repent, change, brought to their knees. But that's not happening. They're working together. And they have plenty of signs, both the Iranians and the Venezuelans, that the United States is going to bail them out. But first, another story of how Iran and Venezuela are working together. And this should be an extreme worry. If you look at the numbers for U.S. citizens, if you look at the numbers, I don't have them on hand, but if you look at them, the numbers of people that are approaching the southern border, of which percentage are Venezuelans, and then you consider what Iran is setting up in Venezuela, how many of the Venezuelans are actually Iranian agents. Now, I think Mr. Stephen Fleury reported on this, how in this year up to now, there's been 70 individuals, this is even a couple weeks old now, 70 individuals that were on the FBI terror watch list that were apprehended at the southern border. That's this year. 15 the year before that, 3 the year before that. So this is just a massive spike in terrorists that are crossing the southern border. How did the terrorists from South America get to the southern border of the United States? Well, they're not technically, a lot of them, from South America. They might have a Venezuelan passport, but the number two man right now that's in charge of all the petrochemical, the Ministry of Oil, all of that, Tarek Kassimi in Venezuela, he's got Lebanese descent, not that that's anything wrong with having Lebanese descent, but in the past, he's been shown, there's been proof that's been shown in CNN reported on this in 2017, that he was actually giving out to Middle Easterners Venezuelan passports. So you get the Middle Easterner, the Iranian, the Arab militia, the Hezbollah guy, you send him on Mayan Air flights. These are flights that are sanctioned by the United States, the national carrier of Iran. You send them down to Venezuela, and Venezuela puts gold in those planes and send them back to Iran. This has been happening for almost a decade now. And then you just push them up. You push them up further to the southern border. And if they're lucky, they'll get across. Now, we haven't seen terrorist attacks in the United States yet, but it's it's impossible to think that they're not here already, that they're not here in the United States, or there in the United States, I should say. So when you see a flourishing relationship with Iran and Venezuela, this is not because Iran loves Venezuela. This is because Iran hates the United States. And it's using Venezuela. It's trying to set up a Syria, if you like, in Venezuela. Turn Venezuela into Syria. Syria is a country right now that's beholden largely to Iran by Hezbollah and other Shiite militias that are inside the country. And we have, this has been reported on for a decade, reported before Congress for a decade. You have Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, bad guys. These are the guys that used to be the henchmen of Qasem Soleimani. They are in Venezuela right now. Some of them are in an island on the north of it called Margarita Island. Tourism, taking a dive since COVID, 80% down. But one thing that's not down, traffic from Iran. There was a flight, a Mayan Air flight, that showed up there 2 months ago. What happened to the 20 people that were on that? Nobody knows. They're setting up a base of operations in Venezuela, the Iranians, and I don't think we have in America too much to say about it, it seems. This is an article from Gladstone. Iran acquires 2.5 million acres of Venezuela. This is what happened earlier this year. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro this June, during a visit to Iran, signed a multi-dimensional 20-year cooperation treaty. The pact includes agreements on science and technology, as well as deals on agriculture, communications, culture, and tourism. The Maduro regime's startling provision of 1 million hectares, roughly 2.5 million acres, nearly 4,000 square miles of farmland to Iran, was kept under wraps until Iranian agrarian economist Ali Ravanzadeh disclosed it to the Venezuelan media. The land will grant ostensibly the use, will ostensibly be used to grow staple crops such as corn and soybeans, allowing water-starved Iran to better feed its population. Iran's current use of Venezuela, however, and it provides proof, some of it I've talked about, combined with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, raise the possibility that Iran and its surrogate terrorist groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas might be using the vast acreage for military and terrorist operations. It makes sense. That's what they're doing. They're using it for terrorist operations. And just look at what's happening in the southern border. They're setting up shop there. They're most likely sending some of their agents across the border, see how far they get. But what does it have to do with the United States? Of course, the United States would be against this, right? Well, the United States was against this. The United States tried to shut down a lot of this during President Trump's tenure. Michael Flynn, I have a quote from Michael Flynn. somewhere in here. This was, of course, the National Security Advisor to President Trump until he was ousted, remember? Why was he ousted? Well, he knew a lot about the deep state. He knew a lot about the problems in the CIA and the FBI. And he was going to clean house as best he could. But he was also an expert on Iran. He was also an expert on what Obama ended up doing in Iran. And he was also an expert on what was happening south of the border in Venezuela. And so Michael Flynn was target number one to be set up, to be removed from that office, from that position of National Security Advisor. This is from an article I wrote a while ago. It's called Iran Establishing a Base of Operations in Venezuela. This is just 2 years ago. I wrote this. It says, he writes in his 2016 book, The Field of Flight. So this is just after he is, or just as he's about to be National Security Advisor, Field of Flight. He said that Venezuela formed part of a nexus of radical Islamists and regimes that held Iran at its centerpiece and linchpin. So he was very, very, very influential in the anti-Iranian policy by the, of the Trump administration, and he had to be removed. Upon taking office, the Trump administration started to play catch-up on Iran's entrenchment in Venezuela by sanctioning individuals from the defunct Operation Cassandra. This is an operation that was set up by the Drug Enforcement Agency during Obama's time, actually. And it exposed this massive narcotics ring that was the starting goal was basically drugs in Venezuela. The end goal was hundreds of millions of dollars for Hezbollah. And they exposed it. The Drug Enforcement Agency, I think it's called. And yet it was shut down. It was shut down by the Obama administration. We can't have exposing that. Those funds to Hezbollah, they're important. The gas deal for Hezbollah, that's important. And so what did Flynn do? This is February 13, while he was still serving, 2017, while he was still serving as National Security Advisor, he sanctioned this man, Tariq Qasemi, this basically Iran's agent in the number two inside Venezuela. Qasemi was sanctioned under the foreign narcotics kingpin designation with tens of millions of dollars of his assets frozen by the American government. And he has a $10 million bounty on his head. And he's the one that's been caught giving Venezuelan passports to Middle Eastern terrorists. He's the man that has been setting up the drug ring, pushing the drugs northward into the United States to eventually fund Hezbollah. And this was something that the Trump administration tried to put a stop to. This is an article, October 5th. U.S. looks to ease Venezuelan sanctions, enabling Chevron to pump. Wall Street Journal, sad to say, gone the way of the others. The editorial board is still okay sometimes, but you know their mainstream reporting, their exclusives, come from leaks. They come from leaks from the Biden administration, and they're put out in piecemeal. We want to start sending this out. And what's it look like? Well, Maduro hasn't changed. He hasn't kind of rebuffed his relationship with the Iranians. He hasn't, you know, given way to capitalism. He's still a dictator. He's still grinding his nation into the dust. But it's time. It's time for the United States to go easy on Venezuela. The Biden administration is preparing to scale down sanctions. This is from last week. On Venezuela's authoritarian regime to allow Chevron, of course, this is good, right? To resume pumping oil there, paving the way for a potential reopening of U.S. and European markets to oil exports from Venezuela in exchange for the significant sanctions relief. So we're going to relieve them from sanctions. We're going to allow Chevron to go in there, get some of their oil, pump some of their oil. Of course, Venezuela will be paid for this. It doesn't talk about that. Maduro would resume long-suspended talks with the country's opposition to discuss conditions needed to hold free and fair elections in 2024. Okay, so it's almost laughable. Both these deals, one with Hezbollah, Lebanon, and one with Venezuela, and they're both being pushed by the Biden administration. And what the Americans get, or what the opposition gets in Venezuela, is the idea that talks are going to resume. What Israel gets in the case of Lebanon is a security guarantee. And you can drill, get gas from your Karish gas field, and Hezbollah won't blow it up. So what is happening here? Why is the United States negotiating these positions? Of course, the United States has created its own oil shortage in its own country to make these ideas look great. Who's got a lot of oil right now? Well, there's Iran that's got a lot of oil. Venezuela's got a lot of oil. And let's bring them back on board. It's good for all of us, right, to get access to this oil. I'm not going to go into more of this. I think Mihailo Zekic has an article that's going to be coming out about this in the future. But Venezuela is a country to watch. I don't know if you're going to see too much about what Iran is doing in Venezuela, but when you see many Venezuelans coming across the border, and I'm definitely not saying every Venezuela that is coming across the border isn't escaping something horrific. I am saying, though, that the IRGC, Iran's terrorists, are there active in Venezuela, extremely active. And they're there, and the Maduro regime is letting them stay there. And they're probably getting Venezuelan passports. And there's been 70 terrorists that have shown up on the southern border in this past year. How did that happen? Where did they come from? I do want to just reference a portion of America Under Attack. This is a really helpful portion if you want to talk about what Obama's foreign policy was in terms of the little state of Israel. Mr. Gerald Flurry writes this: when Barack Obama was president, he was terribly unmerciful to the Jewish nation of Israel. But in Trump's first term, he saved the Jewish nation of Israel, biblical Judah, from much of Obama's tyranny. He supported Israel in many ways, including scrapping the Iran deal, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and helping Israel sign the Abraham Accords with Arab nations in the region. Columnist Lee Smith described the alliance between Israel and the Gulf states as, quote, an impediment to the dream of a re-empowered, nuclear-armed Iran backed by the United States, which was Obama's main foreign policy aim, and an effort to peace processes convinced of their own, affront to peace processes convinced of their own never-ending importance. And so he's talking about here that the main aim of the Obama administration, this is Lee Smith, and Mr. Flurry definitely agrees with this, that their foreign policy aim was to empower a nuclear-armed Iran. A nuclear-armed Iran. Why would he do that? Why would he do that? Is this part of this great realignment in the Middle East where, they could just share the neighborhood, as he said, and get along together? We've been so favorable to the Gulf states and to Israel. Perhaps if we show a little bit of favor to the fanatical regime in Iran that's killing their own people right now for not wearing a headscarf or trying not to. Let's help them out. Or let's even the playing field. Maybe they can just get along. And that's not what we've seen. Mr. Flurry writes, note that Obama's main foreign policy aim was to align America with Iran, Israel's enemy, America's enemy, and the world's number one terror-sponsoring nation. For America to support Iran makes no sense unless you realize that America's leader is trying to blot out the name of Israel, and now that policy is back. These two stories that we've shown today show you that policy is back. That policy of empowering Iran so that it can obtain nuclear weapons and so that it can be strengthened, flush with cash to promote more of its terrorist activities, not just in the Middle East, but also far closer to the United States for what it's doing in Venezuela right now. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to look at a little bit into the Bible of how God describes how the nation of Israel in the future and the world at large is going to be divided up by families.
The Trumpet Daily. One may blind his eyes to existing facts and trends and say the world cannot get any worse than it already is. Or, if we just ignore the conditions and don't worry, perhaps they'll go away. But these conditions and trends won't just go away. Not unless they are caused to go away. The scriptures of the Holy Bible the inspired revelation of the Supreme God, have foretold today's world conditions and trends, and give us the advance news of coming peace on earth, of universal prosperity, of happiness and joy, of veritable utopia. This is the good news of the world tomorrow, and it is absolutely sure. This coming world is vividly described in our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Bible prophecy explains in detail how God will intervene to save mankind from destroying himself. Jesus Christ will return to earth, putting an end to the rule of man and restore God's government on earth. To learn much more about this prophesied utopia, please visit thetrumpet.com. Trumpet Daily.
Here at the Feast of Tabernacles, we have a really big focus on family. Today is Family Day. And I think it's really interesting when you look at ancient Israel and how it was set up, how God really incorporated family into land disputes and or making sure that the nation itself and was divided the right way. I do want to go to a scripture here. This is one that's quoted quite often during this time of year in our services. And also, it's actually quoted a lot by Israelis. They really do know these few verses. This is Isaiah 2 in verse 1 to 4. It talks about how the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Jerusalem and Judah and Jerusalem, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountains of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. So this is a time, obviously, in the very near future when people are going to be coming to Jerusalem for the holy days. Three times a year, they'll be coming up to Jerusalem. Notice this, verse 4, it says this, "And he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." Now, there is one little portion to this last verse. This is, of course, the verse that is depicted in front of the United Nations, an amazing statue of a sword becoming a plowshare. And it's something that will take place because the need for war in the future is going to be gone. And part of the reason why that is even if you look at what we covered today in the first half, is that one of the major reasons for war is land disputes of, you've got land, I want it, so I'm going to come take it, defend yourself. And this is something that is going to be done away with real fast, and Jesus Christ will see to that, not just because he won't tolerate war, but that everybody's national boundaries will be fixed. They will be fixed. It says here from the New Living Translation from verse 4, it says, "The Lord will mediate between nations and will settle international disputes." So there won't be the UN doing it. It won't be the Biden administration doing it. If there is an international dispute, God is going to settle that. But in terms of the borders of each nation, they are going to be largely set. They'll be set by God, and everyone will have right to their piece of land. Another verse that we go to quite often at the Feast of Tabernacles is Micah chapter 4 and verse 3 to 4. We'll read that. Well, we won't read verse 3. We just read it. This is a parallel account to Isaiah. Notice what it says here. It says in verse 4, "But they shall sit." So they're going to be turning their pruning hooks or their weapons into pruning hooks. And what is that going to allow them to do? "They shall sit every man under his vine and every man under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid." Now, this verse is so wonderful because we tend to focus sometimes on the fact that every man's going to have a piece of land, and that'll be true. But the way it was divided up into ancient Israel is that every family had a piece of land. And there were laws set in place to make sure that that piece of land would stay within the family forever. For all of Israel's existence, that piece of land should stay within the family. Now, if you come upon hard times, there were options to lease your land to somebody else. But every 50 years, the law of Jubilee would be in effect. And that would mean the land would go back to the original family. meaning that no family can, no father can defraud his children of it. Here is a time when God is going to set the bounds of the habitation of people. No one's going to be afraid. No one's going to be worried that somebody else is going to take their land. No, God says, that's going to be your land. And this is brought out in the Feast of Tabernacles. This is about everyone and their families staying on a piece of land and making sure that that family stays together. Thank you very much for listening in to today's program. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, filling in for Mr. Stephen Flurry. Please enjoy the Family Day. If you're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles and it's Family Day where you are, enjoy that. If not, perhaps you can take some time with your family today and tell them how special they are. Thanks very much for listening today, and I'll talk to you next time.
Good afternoon. It's the top of the hour.